talk about how we achieve change and development through partnerships. We've got a large panel, so I banned all PowerPoints except mine, because it seemed to me that what would be more interesting is to get people to talk about what they understand a partnership to be and to reflect on what makes a successful partnership. Do you think I could have my PowerPoint slide up? Thanks. Partnerships are quite slippery ideas to define, and we often talk about working in partnership with someone where we frankly mean very little more than just selling through them or with them. A partnership, it seems to me, is more than that. It's about having a notion of a shared objective and cooperating to achieve those shared objectives. It's about working together to achieve these shared objectives. So there needs to be a degree of cooperation, needs to be a shared objective. And I think that in a strong definition of partnership, there has to be some notion of shared risk, that you both lose if you don't deliver what you set out to do together. And I think it's a sign of a not very strong partnership if there isn't a degree of shared risk in what you're talking about. And perhaps in a really strong partnership, a degree of equality in the investment and the effort required to achieve the objective. But I'm going to be very permissive, unusually for me, in this panel, and I'm going to ask each of the panelists first to talk about their experiences of partnerships and what works and what doesn't. So I'm going to start perhaps by asking Ola from, because I think you have the opportunity to reflect, having been at a very senior level in destination management in Iceland and now in destination management in Saudi Arabia. These are two significantly different cultures. I'd just be interested to hear your reflections on how partnerships work in those two different cultures.
Thank you. So I think that when we're talking about tourism, we need to think very carefully about how we define partnerships, because as you were saying when you started, then people often start thinking about partnerships and collaboration from a point of view of a marketing or a selling point of view. Whereas in tourism, I think that partnerships form the baseline of developing a destination successfully. And that means that you need to define your stakeholders from a very wide range, both from the private sector, from the public sector, from the community itself, and you need to be able to make some sort of helix where people are working together. Also, I forgot to mention, but last but not least, academia. So you need to define your stakeholders, and also you need to have a culture of collaboration, or sometimes you need to build that up. In Iceland, we do have a big culture of collaboration. We're a small country with a few inhabitants in a wide geographical area, and I think that one of these success factors of Icelandic tourism in the past 10 years is the conglomerate of partnerships that has been developed, both from often from a marketing point of view, where companies and public-private entities come together to promote a region or an experience or a destination. But also, you know, within companies or between companies themselves, where they start thinking about how they can best address issues of responsibility. And responsibility needs to be allotted, so people need to be able to take that responsibility. So not only do we need to think about the lose-lose factor, but also what are your tasks in achieving a destination that will grow into the future? Comparing that and the maturity that we reached in Iceland in the decade that has passed now, it is an interesting place to be in Saudi Arabia, in the region I work for, which is the region of Al Ula, about 300 kilometers north of Medina, where tourism for leisure is, of course, in its infancy. You could say it's not very highly developed. Saudi Arabia has mainly been receiving religious travelers on a very structured basis, but has the ambitions now to build up destinations And my destination is a cultural and experiential destination. But what I see directly is that there is the necessity of building the same partnerships between between different operators for them, in order for them to be able to mature professionally, and also to build up the partnerships between community, government, and the private sector. And I think that what I found also interesting was that when starting to discuss matters with the tour operators that are in place in Al Ula, I got exactly the same motives for discussion as in Iceland. So it seems that wherever you go, people are thinking about the same things and are looking for solutions to the same challenges, and that can't be achieved unless you build up a big and wide stakeholder collaborative platform, or platforms, if you will.
But surely it's a problem as the number of stakeholders and the number of partners gets bigger and bigger. Surely it's hard to keep that shared objective and the shared goals.
Yes, it is. And I think that's also where governance comes into the picture. Because I think that for tourism, one of the main roles of government or the public sector is to build a framework which is based on shared responsibilities and encourages collaboration, you know, encourages a non-silo way of thinking, because I truly believe that that is the only way to bring a destination forward and to develop it in a sustainable or future vision-minded way, is that people know where to collaborate. And because tourism is, on the face of it, tourism is often, you know, thought of as very simple. You go somewhere, you have a good time, you go home. But it's such a complex endeavor, which with so many layers that come in, that the frameworks are essential, but also the maturity of a dialogue between people. And that's sometimes underestimated, the need for talking. You know, people need to be really good at talking if they want to build up anything within tourism.
Thanks very much for that. Elise, can we come to your experience in the Netherlands before you went to work for the TUI Care Foundation? I think one of the most extraordinary partnerships I've seen in travel and tourism was the one that you developed around the Don't Turn a Blind Eye campaign that you ran with the Border Force and others in Holland. Do you want to just reflect on what made that work? Not so much the impact on the child sex tourism, but just to get that partnership together in the first place.
Yeah, I have to think a little bit hard. It's 5 years ago that we won the World Travel World Responsible Tourism Award for that. What made it work is that I can remember we were five strong women, and we were all experts in our own field, and we took the best of what we could do and we combined it. So it was focusing on supply and demand to protect children from sexual exploitation in travel and tourism. And on the supply side, we were trying to give vocational training to youngsters, young women mainly, and we had to work with a very strong local NGO there, and we worked together with Plan International, also a very strong woman working in the Netherlands who would make it happen in Brazil. It was in Brazil. And then in the Netherlands, we were trying to stop the demand of sexual exploitation towards the destinations, not in particular Brazil. And we worked together with the Dutch Tourism Association, so that not only TUI would be part of it, but the complete tourism industry. And we hooked up with the police force, but also with the military police, the Maréchaussée. And we started a national campaign. When you would leave the country, you would receive in your passport really a folder about if you see something, you can act. And you would have big posters. The posters are still there every 5 years. It's already there for 5 years, and every year it's repeated, this national campaign to protect children.
So just to be, for my sake, and I think possibly for the audience, what we have here is an institutional set of relationships that turned on a strong woman in each of those institutions. And that's what made the partnership work.
Yeah, because you need a lot of, some cliche, you need a lot of talking. And you need a lot of trust, and you need a lot of you need a lot of years to accomplish such a relationship that you trust each other and you go the extra mile for the other. You cannot stop in. You cannot do this for half a year and then think their partnership is there. You need years. And I'm still talking to these women in the military police or the one from Plan as she moved on to UNICEF, but we are still there for child protection.
So in this case, the partnership was around key individuals at the time, but that has continued even when some of those people have moved on in their careers.
Yeah.
Interesting example. Caroline, let's come to Scotland now, because you've had the experience in recent years of working for the Private Sector Trade Association in doing destination development, and now you've gone over to the other side, worked for Visit Scotland, doing partnership development on the east coast of Scotland, or the east of Scotland. What do you think makes a strong partnership work?
I think a lot of the messages have probably come out already. So in my previous job at the Scottish Tourism Alliance, my job was, I was responsible for coordinating the national tourism strategy. So previously, the national tourism strategy was a typical national tourism strategy. It was led by the Tourist Board and the Scottish Government, but it wasn't working. The industry was saying, well, that's fine. Strategy's over there. We'll just get on with doing what we do. So when the last tourism strategy came out, we changed that. And we said, right, well, let's put it into the private sector. So the Scottish Tourism Alliance took on responsibility for the coordination of the strategy. And that was my role, was to try and keep a hold of everything. And you can imagine trying to coordinate the delivery of a tourism strategy at a national level was quite a challenge. But it was all about partnerships. We couldn't have achieved the tourism strategy, which we're now starting to look at the next one, without partnerships. And those partnerships work at all different levels. And in terms of what is successful, I think there needs to be strong leadership. So I think there need to be a number of people who are prepared to step forward and say, this is something I believe in and I will put effort into it. But I think they can't step forward without any support behind them. So as is so often the case with a lot of the tourism associations, they're run on a shoestring with very limited resources. And I think if a partnership is actually going to work, there needs to be proper resource. It doesn't have to be cash, but there needs to be proper resource to kind of underpin the effort. So, and that was me. Partly my role was to try and drive things forwards. I think there needs to be a common purpose. I think everybody needs to recognise that we've all got our own agendas and our own roles and responsibilities, but unless we actually focus in on delivering a few things well, we'll end up delivering lots of things not particularly well. And I think last but not least, I would say that the sort of aims and objectives and the key performance indicators that you aim at, you've come up with at the beginning, are not necessarily the only success from a partnership. And certainly what I've seen, and going into my new role at the Scottish Tourist Board, is that actually it's about building relationships with people, and that those relationships, as Elise was saying, will continue on. And it's around trust, and it's around that kind of, it's a shared purpose, that it's not all about cash at the end of the day. It's not all about sales.
So you seem to be saying, in that long and eloquent answer to the question, you okay. seem to be saying that two things that are really critical is, one, that the shared purpose is evolved together, so it's genuinely a shared purpose. So no agency can give that shared purpose to, and that I think was true in your case, Elise, that it developed out of a conversation between, and the second principle seems to be they need to be people within their, each in their own organisation, that have resources and strength and can commit to a partnership.
It's which not, doesn't have to be
just
cash.
A lot of it is effort rather than cash. So that's a broad agreement. Olaf, does that make sense to you as well?
Yes, I think that all those points that have been taken are very relevant.
And okay, so let's go across the pond to America. Paula, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Harold.
Does this sound the same to you across the pond?
Across the pond, looking at sort of the American tourism market. I think there's the adventure market, and there's also sort of the mainstream mass market. And at Tourism Cares, we have about 150 companies that are members of ours. We're an industry-supported nonprofit, so we unite the industry to come together. And I've seen that by uniting around doing good, a common good, there's the ability to create a dialogue and a bonding experience. And I think it's important when you talk about partnerships that partnerships really exist, I think, in tourism to really support destinations. It's very much about sort of a triangle. It's the nonprofit world, it's the business world, and it's the government world. And sort of without that triangle, it's very difficult to create any kind of progress. I do believe that cross-sector dialogue is really important. And at Tourism Cares, we're trying to create, we're a convening body. We're a catalyst and a conduit to this kind of change. But there needs to be the nonprofit or some entity, some organization driving that forward. Without the ability to have, someone needs to hold that space. And in my previous lives as well, working on cross-sector dialogues and cross-sector collaborations, the only way to really affect change is to have someone driving it forward. And it's very difficult for business or grassroots nonprofits or governments to do that. Someone needs to be a convening around that and create a shared dialogue around what you're trying to accomplish. And I think in America, we are new to this concept of shared value. We are new to the idea that everyone needs to be in this together. And when you talk about risk, Harold, it's the risk that these destinations are going to decline, that they're going to really start to see the impacts of over-tourism and the plastics issue and pollutions and poverty going really in the wrong direction. And so we are trying to say, okay, how do we really collaborate? How do we really talk about the fact that everyone is selling, all of these big companies, the thousands and thousands of companies out there are selling the same places. We're all selling the same places. So it's in our best interest to say, okay, how do we come together to create local community empowerment, to tackle this plastics issue that's really creating a decline for our destinations? And then, because we have a common bond and a common dialogue, we can see the benefit of moving forward together. So that's what we're trying to do in the U.S. with these great big companies, but it's a new concept, honestly. It's a new idea of really connecting local opportunities with the benefit of the destination.
It seems to me that I'm an outsider in this. I know very little about America other than what I read in the newspapers. But it seems to me that in America, Tourism Cares, which is your organization, works with some of the very biggest distribution channels in the world. Yeah? So in the main, your organization is made up of very large corporates. And you've been very successful at that. But the common agenda has been around charitable giving, really. It's CSR2.
Yeah.
It's not changing the way you do the business, which has been much more in the last, 10 years, the European approach. There's quite a big difference. And it seems to me that for the second thing, and we'll come to the tour operators in a minute, but it seems to me to do CSR3, if we call it that, that notion of changing the way you do the business, you need higher levels of partnership, because you're moving from just giving money away to actually partnering to achieve change in more complicated ways. Is that fair?
That is fair. I think that is fair. I think a lot of U.S. companies are really looking at their CSR from outside of their sector. They're looking at Cancer Society or Make-A-Wish or Ronald McDonald House. These are. It's very much outside of their sector. And at Tourism Cares, we're working to have a dialogue around how do we really create more change within their sector? How do we really have your CSR align with your core business values? Because at the end of the day, that's going to support your product. Your employees are going to feel more connected to their own work. And really, these CSR programs have the ability to really shift into their own business and invest in their own sectors. And that's the dialogue that we're starting. How do we really support local economies? How do we support the environment? Because that is your product. And if your product is going to decline, then, you know, you really aren't investing in the corporate social responsibility of your business. And I think when we start to see how that, we're starting to have those conversations and it's starting to have a ripple effect. And I think the beauty about one small change with the size of the companies at our table, it creates it can create a huge impact. And so we're really strongly encouraging our members now to invest their CSR in their market capital of their own businesses.
And how difficult is it to create the partnerships to do that?
I think what we're starting to have a conversation around and a convening around is bringing leaders in, like Intrepid, who's a member, bringing some of the leaders in the industry who are really starting to push this, to push the needle on this, and sharing those best practices. And that's why when I talk about the convening and a shared dialogue, it's a collaborative place that we want to create, not a competitive one. So everyone that's in this tent really learns from the leaders, and there really is a desire now, because the companies in our membership are really starting to see that this is the way business is going. To be a sustainable business, you have to incorporate sustainable practices, and that's the convening that we're trying to create.
Let's come then to the tour operator perspective on this, because clearly one of the challenges for any tour operation is you're out there buying products and services from all kinds of people. They've got all kinds of relationships. You're often operating in a country that you are coming from outside of. And it's complex. It's very complex for a tour operator. Glyn, do you want to reflect on what makes the partnerships work around your organization?
Yes, I think there are a few things. The first is that we have a myriad of partnerships that we have to work with. They start with the fact that we manage community-owned lodges and activities. So our starting point is with communities very often not particularly well developed. And so we have government involvement and often NGO involvement. And though that involvement very often premises around the fact that for the community, they're told you want to be in tourism because you're going to make a lot of money. So that's the founding premise of it. Then we are in a partnership with tour operators and through the tour operators, their clients. And the clients' expectations are very different sometimes to what is actually on the ground. And so you end up in this challenge where in one particular instance, and we'll take this discussion offline because I won't mention the name of the company today, but we have a situation where in a village, when our guests arrive, the children are banned from swimming in the swimming pool, in the rock pools in the mountainside, because it's now no longer their village, it's the village of the guests, and the guests don't want to see these children swimming there. And that's where the issue of partnership becomes so important, because how do you manage it? How do you manage a situation where guests say to their tour operator they're not happy to go to a tavern in a village which they really wanted to go to, but they're not happy to go there because there are drunk people at the tavern and they don't want to see children dancing as part of a traditional dance group. Now my challenge is I go to Wetherspoons and I take my 2-year-old grandson and it's okay for him to be there with drunk people. But it's not okay to be like that in Africa. So it is a question of where do you draw the line? Why is it okay for me to go to a castle in the UK and see a beefeater all dressed up and everything else, but it's not okay to see a bushman take off his chai and put on his Western t-shirt because that's not what the guest expects to see. And it's not okay for me to go to Holland and not see everybody wearing their clogs, but it's a problem for people to come to South Africa and not see every bushman wearing their traditional clothing. And I think that's a conversation that we need to really take, because the consequence of this is that very often, and it's not necessarily the tour operator themselves, the international tour operator, but often their ground handler, who is fearful that the comments of the guests might convert into a problem for them. So it's easier to say, don't do it. And then comes the bullying part. If you don't do it, we will take our business away. So all of a sudden, a village whose people have thrived because they've had visits to the taverns, they've had dinners in homes, and they've earned a reasonable income, and they now have some dignity and a decent way of life, are being told, if you continue doing that, we're afraid we're taking our business somewhere else. And that's part of where we need to...
It's this aspect of the problem partnership that caused me to put up the bits about the shared risk and the notion of where is the equality in the partnership. Because most of the partnership, well, I'm not sure about Scotland, Caroline, to be honest, but most of the other partnerships are basically between fairly equal organisations. Visit Scotland is a big organisation. But in that tour operator relationship and the multiple relationships where there's a client and a purchaser, it's potentially fraught with difficulty, it seems to me, because you're bringing together as well. It's one of the reasons I wanted to explore these cultural differences about what is the understanding in different source markets and destinations and how those things balance.
Sure.
Can we come to Intrepid? Because you operate in how many countries? This must be an enormous challenge for you.
Yeah, over 120. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's 120 countries, culturally about as diverse as the planet is. I guess you don't do North Korea. But, you know, in a sense, you do an enormous number of very different countries, very different cultural expectations. You're a very devolved structure, seems to me. You're in the main, you lose local guides and so on. How do you hold all that together with a set of what are very strong in Intrepid, the shared cultural values in terms of the outbound markets you serve? How do you see those partnerships between your company and what's happening in destinations?
Yeah, so with Intrepid Group, our style of travel is all about immersive local experiences, and you know, that's what we make a business out of. That's why we're able to carry over 400,000 people on trips around the world every year. And so the way in which we manage it and operate it is we have our own destination management companies in region, 21 of them throughout the world, who oversee the network of 1,100 leaders and staff. And I suppose critically, we're trying to form long-term partnerships within these local markets to ensure that we get the best, most sustainable experiences possible. You know, short-term partnership can typically never work because there's not enough mutual long-term gain to happen. And so, particularly for Intrepid Group, we want to focus on creating shared value, find a method, often where we're trying to solve a problem or an issue in the world. And so, you know, good examples of that have been issues in places like Thailand, where, you know, up until 3, 4, 5 years ago, elephant riding was considered the norm. You know, you'd be at WTM 5 years ago, go to any of the Asia stands, pick up a brochure, and elephant riding would be slam bang on the front of it. And the Intrepid Foundation conducted a piece of research in 2013 with World Animal Protection, and we found that of 118 elephant venues, only 4 met the basic standards of animal welfare. But at the time for Intrepid, I think 40% of our business went to Southeast Asia, and so we had a particularly commercial challenge or risk that if we took the decision to ban elephant riding, we might compromise the commercial aspects of our business. But I think we felt strongly that the research was so compelling that we had to take a stand, and we're one of the first tour operators globally to take the step to ban elephant riding. And as a result, we got enormous media coverage from that, and a year later, Thailand was growing at a faster rate than it was in the year prior. And I think we found that if you make the right decision, back it up with the right research, and form a long-term partnership in region, that you can actually get a better outcome for passengers. And so passengers are now traveling to Thailand, being educated around elephant welfare experiences, and actually getting a better travel experience, I think, locally. So it's one micro example of how we were able to take a kind of strong purpose-led agenda, but still come out with a positive growth aspect for the organisation.
It seems to me, though, that there's still the problem in that description of an admirable process. There's still the problem that was the risk shared? I mean, you took a bit of a risk when you decided to do it, but there was a reasonable chance that your market would follow you. But the people who are providing those elephant experiences in Thailand, what happened to them?
So, you know, I would say we took a substantial risk, given that 40% of our business went to that part of the world. And, you know, we are a commercial business. And so if suddenly there are many other tour operators out in the market that people could choose to go and ride elephants with. So definitely a very strong, big commercial risk to us. terms of the people that were supporting the elephant riding process, I suppose we've put quite a bit of money through the foundation into elephant research centres, elephant sanctuaries, trying to educate local people around the impacts of elephant riding. And hopefully through the money we're able to put and the people that we're able to now take to these sanctuaries, it's obviously a number of jobs created within those sanctuaries, which create a sustainable form of income for local people. So definitely alternative propositions for locals.
But in terms of that long-term partnership that you'd had with the elephant providers, are you able to say what happened to those individuals who you were in partnership with?
No. No, absolutely not. No, no, of course not. We can't say to every individual elephant operator that we were using previously that we know exactly what's happened to them previously. But we can say for sure that the size and scale of the sanctuaries that we work with have increased, and that new roles have been created as a result of the tourists that we're taking through to those sanctuaries. So while in some respects there are partnerships that over the course of the time come to a natural conclusion, there are also partnerships that you build on and take forward that can grow going forward.
And you get new partnerships come out of it. I accept that. Elise?
Yeah, what is so interesting about Intrepid, and I will represent TUI now in the old days, because you have done major work in your part of the world to step down from the elephant rides and shows. And it was TUI Netherlands who started in 2009 as well, but we did it more in Europe.
Yep.
And the interesting thing about the project started within TUI in Europe, and then it was plan A, first to stop the elephant rides and shows, but we were trying to find elephant-friendly venues to go to, but we couldn't find that many, and that's why you and I are still working, or TUI Care Foundation and Intrepid are still funding World Animal Protection to go towards creating more elephant-friendly venues. But you can already see quite some years we're working on it, and hopefully in February, I think, we will open the first elephant-friendly venue, which came really from a commercial standard elephant venue to this. But you see, once again, you need powerful tour operators on all sides of the world, and you need a lot of time. And then you can change the system.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Should we go to the floor now? Does anybody have a question you'd like to ask?
Harold, if I could just pipe in on one note from Elise. I think, you know, moving from organizations that you've been working with a long time because the research comes out, or we start to understand how to use tourism as a force for good, I think this is when these partnerships are incredibly important. You know, we talked about the orphanage tourism issue that I know Intrepid has pulled out of and TUI is very, very active on. I think one of the big things about that is if you're going to pull out or you're going to change these practices that we now, you know, through awareness or through research, we don't want to support anymore, it's really important to create partnerships within this sector and within the tourism industry to say, how do we get out of them? You know, if we're going to divest from orphanages, how do we do that? And so this dialogue, I feel it's really important to have a cross-sector dialogue or to have a dialogue or have a forum where companies can learn and be supported in a collaborative space to just do the right thing, to move all of our industries in the right direction. And I think many times we're sort of preaching to the choir, but we really need to get a partnership around the companies that want to do better, but they just don't know how, and the companies that have been through this pain and been through this brain damage, and create a forum for that conversation. I think there's so much to be learned from the experiences that many companies have been through.
Can you all hear? Because my sense is the noise is getting higher and higher around us. Was that your point? Can we put the sound levels up a bit? Because people are not hearing what's being said. Do you have a question as well? I think it's coming.
Partnerships also mean compromises. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So partnerships also mean compromises and accepting imperfect solutions. And you've got a name and you've got a reputation and you want to protect that, but at the same time you know that unless you accept that compromise, you're not going to get your partners to move forward. How do you deal with that?
I'll take that one, James.
Sir?
Would you like to take that one? first and then Glenn.
Okay. how do you find compromise? I suppose it's being super open around the objectives that you've got at the start and really trying to identify what those goals are that you're both looking for. And I think one thing we've found, particularly working sometimes with certain NGOs or not-for-profit organisations, is that they sometimes have struggled to accept that Intrepid Group is a for-profit organisation, and as a for-profit organisation we need to we want to grow our passenger numbers, and we want to get a commercial outcome that ultimately creates a competitive advantage. And if we're able to do that, then we're able to often take more travellers to a certain part of the world, and as a result that can benefit the organisation we're working with or the country and environment we're working with. And I suppose just being really open and honest about that right at the start, because we've had some wonderful partnerships, like with Tourism Cares, and we've had some other partnerships with other organisations where they haven't worked because we probably weren't quite open and frank enough right at the start around what we're both trying to achieve. And so I think that's pretty important.
But James, just on that point specifically, I mean, one of the things about the outbound, particularly the outbound travel and tourism industry, is just how fast it changes. So if you've got a long-term relationship, and you quite rightly make the point that partnerships need to be long-term, they can't just be short-term. But almost inevitably, if you have a long-term relationship, there will be major change, won't there?
For sure there'll be major change. And so you'll have long-term partnerships where we've worked with an established community or an established operator. There can be political changes into a part of the world. There can be social changes, environmental changes. You know, we had many long-standing partnerships in the country of Nepal, and then in 2015 there's the most horrendous earthquake, and suddenly the country of Nepal is faced with potentially an even worse disaster than the earthquake itself, which is that their number one form of income, which is tourism, there's going to be no travellers travel back to the country. And so Trepid did quite a piece of work, and I mean, it's raising money, but we've got to get people travelling back to the country in question. And so first of all, it's making it safe and secure, where we've done a significant piece of work, but then critically trying to encourage passengers back to the country of Nepal. We did an initiative where we gave up the profits for the 2015-16 trekking season to encourage passengers back, because if they didn't, then quite frankly there was going to be an even worse economic and social disaster on the ground than the terrible earthquake itself. So as tour operators and as travel people, we have a responsibility to try and get that distribution of wealth and income, but make sure it's sustained even when there are environmental or social or political challenges. But of course sometimes that isn't possible for, you know, for a variety of reasons.
Olaf, you were trying to come in.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to that word compromise, you know, in the question of partnerships, and then possibly from a point of view of environmental responsibility or quality even. I think that I don't think compromise is always the most relevant word in that context, but maybe something like realism, because you can have a future goal which is somewhere up here, but the reality of the industry as it is in the destination that you're working with or in the partnerships that you have is that everybody's here even though they want to be here. So you need to have this long-term relationship where you're not compromising, but you're starting at a platform where everybody has an equal opportunity to play, you know. So because you have to start somewhere, and you need to have a long-term goal to go up there. But if you start up there, then you might, you know, alienate the people that you most want to work with, and the people that would benefit, and the industry that would, and in the local economy that would benefit from that. So, you know, because compromise can be a negative word, but it can also mean that you're starting a meaningful relationship which you want to grow and raise the bar for.
Glenn, can we come back to this issue of the nature of the power relationship between the partners?
I think that's really, for me, quite key. It starts with defining expectations. You know, so often, sometimes things are hit and miss. It's a request from a tour operator who will say, "Oh, our guests would love to go to a tavern in the town, so organize it." But do they actually understand what that means? Do they understand what it means to the people of the town? Do they understand what it means to take people there and how you are potentially changing people's lifestyles. And often that's not the case. So then what you don't have is you don't have an educational process that the tour operator takes their clients through their guides or whatever it is. Begging's a perfect example in the previous discussion, and I won't go into it in any detail, but that's a perfect example of what happens. Our guides will say to the guests of a tour operator, please, whatever you do, don't hand out money. The tour operator's guide doesn't want to upset their own guests necessarily, so they don't say too much because it might impact on their tip. So the money then gets handed out to the client, and then we get the complaint by the client to the kids in the street, and then we get the complaint to say, oh, there's a problem, we're going to take our tours away from you because the kids all beg in the street. Well, you know, who made the kids beg in the street? They didn't used to. So it's, how do you balance that kind of thing is a discussion that I think needs to take place at a senior level and not just at a kind of a DMC level where someone has been given the job of developing a product. So I'll just develop something. Because what you're doing, when it doesn't work for you because the parameters weren't right, then the threat is, oh, we'll just take it away. Now, a town, an entire village, may have set up a whole infrastructure to provide meals, got people involved, they've been earning a living, there's a dignity to that town, and the next thing, it's just, boom, gone, out of the blue. And that, for me, it is about dialogue, and I think it's a dialogue that has to take place at a reasonably senior level within companies, that companies need to set their objectives for their product managers and their tours and say, this is what we want to do and how we would like to achieve it, so that when there are challenges, you can iron them out, and it's done in a sensible manner.
Just to put this into another context, I've been working recently somewhere in East Africa, we better leave it as vague as that, where the intention of the tour operators is to make sure that the business goes only to those organizations on the ground which are community-owned, well-organized, meet all the standards and everything else. The driver guides set off from the capital city with the tourists, and they don't go there. They go to other provision. So the tour operator, the inbound tour operator based in the capital city, is struggling to control what's actually happening on the ground. But it's cheaper for that guide to walk away from the established relationship that's been paid for between the head office and the local business and go and do something with another operation, because the commissions will be sufficiently lucrative to make that worthwhile around the craft and the begging and the other things. So it's a really complicated process with a very long chain, it seems to be, to make these partnerships work. And that's partly what you're describing.
Exactly. For me, it is the word partnership, and someone said it earlier on, it's about a long-term thing. It's not about an immediacy. It's not that you just say, oh, well, we're partners this week, but we're not partners next week. If you go into these things, you go into it as a partnership, looking at all of the aspects and making sure that you do what you can to make it work.
Somebody from the audience, is there another question on this or a comment? Is there an example of a good partnership that's worked well? I think the microphone's coming over to you. It is. It's just behind you.
No, I just wanted to comment on what you're referring to. I've been working in social economic development for over 24 years in transitional societies, mainly post-Soviet transition. Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, Taiwan, they all went through a transition. It took them anywhere from 60 to up to 100 years to go through it successfully. So Taiwan can operate today by Western European standards. So what you're referring to is transitional development and expectations. Expectations and reality have to have a balance. A lot of times the international market has very high expectations, but the reality is here. But when you start looking at Ethics 101, other transitional societies, it's 60 to 80 years, up to 100 years, for them to be able to go from here to here. So a lot of the operators internationally, they have that problem when they're working with, let's say, developing societies, because at the end of the day, it's expectations of the tourists that will govern whether or not, let's say, the macro company will work with the local suppliers or not. So there is that balance and that learning curve that is required, and I 100% agree.
And that's, if I can just say, that's where the interpretation is so important. Again, just to give you an example, because these are all concrete examples. We have a situation where one of our clients complained because they go into the home of a family in a village and they can't understand, and they're not happy that the family don't sit down at the table with them and have dinner with them and then engage in discussions about what's happening in American politics and what's happening with Brexit and what's happening here, and we should have a chat about all of these things, because actually they're quite rude. They don't join the guests. But in their culture, it is rude to join the guests. So they don't do that. And if there isn't an intermediary that will explain that, then people leave with the wrong impressions.
One of the reasons I wanted to pursue this theme is that it seems to me, with more and more emphasis in the experiential areas of travel and tourism, we are more and more going to see people from source markets interacting with people at quite a local level in destinations. And one of the reasons we all like working in travel and tourism is the cultural differences which exist between one society and another. But if we're not very careful, everywhere becomes the same in terms of that tourist expectation. Now, if we don't do it right, it might be better that people do just have the same experience. I mean, I think of, Paul, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I think of Niagara Falls, which nobody in their right mind can surely defend. I mean, what has happened
Nor
there
alive.
Is nobody. I've never heard anybody defend it.
Right.
It's horrendous. But what was a fantastic natural icon on the American side has become a kind of Las Vegas.
Yeah.
It's lost all of its sense of a cultural place. And I think we need to think really hard about how we make these partnerships between people travelling from source markets who really want that local experience, and how you make it possible for the local experience to survive the onslaught of the tourism. And that's partly the over-tourism agenda, but I want to avoid that today. It's happening all over the place, it seems to me. Caroline, you're looking...
No, I mean, I think it's the more we travel, the more we take our own personal cultures to the destinations that we go and visit. And I think that's really difficult. I mean, I'm thinking of some of the work that's happening in Scotland at the moment, and obviously China and the Far East are being seen as potential markets for us. And I was just thinking through the complexity of, you know, we're working with the travel industry on the ground so that they can understand the needs of the Chinese market and what they like. And you think, well, we want to be seen as welcoming and accommodating, but should people be coming in and looking for Scottish culture when they arrive? But we're trying to be hospitable and we want to be hospitable. And so I think there's that middle ground, and I think that's a really... It's very difficult because, as you say, the risk is that it all becomes a bland... same everywhere, but I'm sure there's a PhD in there somewhere.
I think it's probably a whole field of PhDs already being written.
If I can just add, and it's got nothing to do with tourism, but it exactly explains that. I was at a Slow Food Foundation conference in Italy a few years ago, and there was someone stood up and started to talk about bananas. I thought, this is crazy. I've never heard a topic like this. And the guy went on about how, and I'd probably get it wrong, whether it's Monsanto or whoever it is, but someone is wanting to try and make sure that every banana produced anywhere in the world looks exactly the same. It's the same length, the same width, the same color, the same everything, because that's what their client wants. They forget that the bananas are produced for different reasons. They're different qualities, they're different styles, they're different foodstuffs, they're different medicinal plants, they're different everything. But they go into these villages and tell people, this is what you will plant and how you will do it and you will deliver it. And it's crazy. And if we're going to turn tourism into that, then we're going mad.
I think a really important component of this, when we talk about this experiential travel and this immersive, authentic exchange, is to really look for ways to differentiate that. That has a social impact, that has a positive social impact. And really incredible partnerships can be forged with nonprofits all around the world that are already doing this work And just as an example, we did a program in Florida to help with the hurricanes after they had wiped out a couple of the keys. And we said, okay, let's partner with some of the opportunities for cleaning up the mangroves and really supporting those communities. But we also said the coral reefs in Florida, 97% of the coral reefs are gone. There's only 3% left. So let's figure out a nonprofit that's working on coral reefs. We brought them into our event, and we said, okay, you can go for a dive in Florida, but you could also dive with this particular Coral Restoration Foundation and plant coral in their coral nursery and have this incredible experience, but you're also giving back. You're also making a small contribution. And at that event, we had three or four cruise industry executives who didn't even know that was an issue in Florida. And I tell the story again and again. The coral reefs are dying. Once they're gone, the fish are gone. The fishermen have no livelihood, and you don't have any snorkel trips to sell. You don't have any dive trips to sell. So forging these partnerships on the ground with nonprofits that are doing this work and creating a unique experience. You know, you can do that in Florida and in New Orleans and Cambodia and you know, Cambria. You can do that everywhere in the world. And those kinds of partnerships and those experiences are going to create positive social impact in the communities. Your guests have a really unique experience. It's a differentiator. And those small ripples, if all of these companies that are doing that, finding those kinds of partnerships, and it takes a long time. It's not, as James knows, it is not easy. Culturally, it's difficult. There's a lot of stops and starts. Projects will blow up on you and you'll have to start over. But like moving into that space of really looking for the right opportunities to create positive change in the destinations, because it just benefits those destinations and your product. Those are important partnerships, I think, that product development teams, marketing teams can look for and just begin those small steps to make change.
One of the ways in which the relationship between the UK and the USA is often described in Britain is of two nations divided by a similar language. That actually we use words which mean something completely different to somebody on the other side of the Atlantic when you hear it. And when you think about that complexity in terms of what we're trying to deliver in the travel and tourism industry, in so many, particularly for a company like Intrepid, so many destinations and countries, and the differences within countries as well as between them, I think we see what the complexity of the problem is. But part of it must surely be around long-term relationships and very careful articulation of what each partner in the partnership is delivering, and really strong transparency around that. Because probably quite a lot of the problem exists because of misunderstandings. But working to avoid that in an industry which is price sensitive and cost sensitive is, I think, quite a big challenge. Does anybody on the panel want to have a final thought? Or a final thought they wish to articulate? Maybe a different thing.
I just want to say that I think it's fantastic, A, to have had as many people listening to this discussion, but also to have the discussion. Because I think very often it's not, the discussion is not held. And as a consequence, frustrations arise. And it often goes back to, as you were saying earlier, Harold, the sort of the power struggle or the power relationship. And that's not either transparent or in the best interests of resolving the problem.
You just thank the panel, I'd be grateful.